Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation to give a talk at this nice conference. So my talk will be based on work done with Matteo Beccaria, Simone Giombi, Guido Macorini, and Arkady Tsaitin earlier this year. Is it any better now? Maybe. Right. So it's based on work done earlier this year, as well as on some older results. So integrability in N equals 4 super Young Mills and for strings in ADS allows us, in principle at least, to determine the spectrum of anomalous dimensions of operators for any value of the coupling. And the current strategy that we use at the moment is to, in fact, assume all-order integrability, construct BTNs, let's say, of various flavors, and which explain the existing data, make predictions, and check predictions. And the predictions are checked, then we're happy. If they are not checked, then we go back and fix things, and we repeat. So the weak coupling tests of integrability go all the way to 4 or 5 loops, and there is some guidance from various sources. And the strong coupling, the checks have been carried out to 2 loops. And perhaps the best established part of the story is in the context of long operators, where the asymptotic beta ansatz has reached a more or less final form. There's a long list of people who should have appeared here before in the first 7 years of the story, but pretty much everybody is in the room, so let me not mention everyone. As I said, it's been tested at weak and strong coupling and for various kinds of string configurations. And people studied fast strings that are relatively close to BPS. They've studied long strings, from which the classic example is the GKP string, which appeared also in Benjamin's talk yesterday. So for this guy, the essential quantity is this function f of lambda in front of log s scaling at large s. And this is perhaps the best evaluated quantity at weak and at strong coupling. Both of these regimes are captured by the BES equation with a known solution. Now, there is, of course, a generalization of this guy and of the fast strings that covers both of them. And these are the long and fast strings, for which the classic example is this guy with an additional charge, which is sort of commensurate to the spin. And, everything that we know for this guy also checks out. Now, this is the story for long strings, sort of a gazipped version of long string story. For short operators, which are supposed to be dual to general quantum states, the story is somewhat less established, at least from some perspective. The integrability-based results certainly improve the asymptotic beta ansatz, and there are various flavors of approaches. Luisher corrections, TBA and TBA in Y variables, with the suspects contributing there. So at least the TBA in Y variable can be sort of compressed in half a slide, so here it is. So it's a set of functional equation whose solution is supposed to be the spectrum. And I understand that some additional constraints need to be imposed to actually get a physical solution on top of these. And these physical constraints have been worked out. And they turn out to be related to the Z4 automorphism of the four-dimensional superconformal algebra. And they led to a simpler set of equations than these, and we'll hear about them from Sebastian in 2 days or so. In any case, the main assumptions that go into this, at least this last part of the story, is that quantum integrability holds in finite volume to all orders, and also that both the string sigma model as well as the gauge theory spin chain obey the Hirota equation. Perhaps one can say that some indication that the second one holds has been offered by Benishu's work on the sigma model. However, the quantum integrability in finite volume remains to be proven to all orders. And analysis, yes. Thank you. Nevertheless, here is, So, again, the story is we guess, we check, and then we go back if we need to. So the simplest example, which is perhaps also the only really studied example, is the Ponisci multiplet, and we will pretend that he will be our friend for the next 30 minutes or so. So this is what we know at weak coupling, and the circled things are the obvious deviations from ABA, which will not produce a zeta 5 at 4 loops or a zeta 7 at 5 loops. So the last line was originally predicted based on Luscher corrections, and as we've heard from Emery earlier today, it's been recently checked by solid field theory calculations to be this way. At strong coupling, we'll talk a little bit more about this in a little bit, but for now the Ponisci multiplet is, let me just state for now that the Ponisci multiplet is supposed to be dual to the first excited string level, and from worksheet analysis, which I will describe in detail, it seems to follow that this should be its expansion at large lambda, where A1, A2, A3 are numbers. And they have some specific values which have been determined for one particular state in the Ponisci multiplet from by solving numerically the Y system and at weak coupling and extrapolating at strong coupling. These are the values that appear to come out. And also from worksheet calculations, based on some number of assumptions, A0 comes out to be the same, A1 comes out to be relatively close, and using a conjecture of Benjamin's regarding a specific contribution to this specific coefficient, it seems to follow that A2 is also relatively close to its numerically obtained value. Now, it turns out that there are a few more predictions that one can make without straining too much and without doing higher loop calculations, and that is that the higher loop analog of these guys have a transcendentality structure that looks roughly like this. The kth loop coefficient has a zeta of 2k minus 1, and one can also see relatively easily that the coefficient here should be, computationally speaking, one can see relatively easily that this is universal within the multiplet as it should be. So here is an example. The three-loop coefficient A should have this structure with a 15-half coefficient in front of zeta 5, and we'll sort of talk about deriving this in a little bit. So that's sort of a summary of what we know. So there are, of course, lots of open questions, and here are four that I came up with. Quickly, there surely are a few more. So, from a TBA perspective, these numbers have been derived from for a single state. The question is, can one identify some more general features of the structure of the energy in terms of the other charges? And can one do this from a TBA perspective? And moreover, what kind of numbers should appear inside these values? Here we see a zeta 3 and we see a zeta 5 here, and we see other zetas, but there are all sorts of other transcendental numbers that exist in the world, and some of them, like the Dirichlet beta function, appears for long strings, so one might imagine that some other guys like this could appear, and it would be useful to know if they do. It would be interesting to know why they don't if they don't. So there's, of course, the open question of an analytic calculation in the TBA, and of course, there is also the story about repeating these calculations for other states in an attempt to check that the symmetry structure is correctly encoded. And last but certainly not least, there is certainly the need of a systematic comparison between the near-flat space spectrum and, say, the TBA. So now these are some open questions, and oddly enough, I won't answer any one of them. Instead, I will deal with these other things. So we will discuss how to understand the structure of the energy as a function of other charges, not from TBA, but from a worksheet perspective. We will evaluate some 1 over root lambda corrections, or better said, we will fish out all the valuations, and we will make sure that things that should belong to the same multiplet, like the Konishi multiplet, actually do belong to the Konishi multiplet, with some twists and turns. And we will also make some predictions for some coefficients that appear in here, which have not yet been computed directly. And then we'll break for the day. So that's the outline of what I'll talk about. I'll start with a brief organization of states. We'll spend some time on the structure of the energy corrections, and then we'll proceed with some calculations, and that will be the end. Any questions? All right. So organization of states. ADS, at least in the large volume limit, is a relatively flat space. In fact, it's extremely close to flat space from several points of view. So one might expect that as one dials down the curvature, one gets strictly flat space, and as one dials up the curvature, nothing terribly drastic happens. And indeed, to some extent, this is true. So let's start with the flat space spectrum for a little bit. So it's best constructed in Lipkin gauge, and it is usually presented as a mass spectrum in terms of the level, the string level, which is defined in terms of left and right number operators. So this would be in NSR plus a GSO projection. This would be in a Green-Schwarz presentation, in a Green-Schwarz approach. So the ground state, as far as representation theory is concerned, looks like this. It's constructed out of, the vacuum state is just this. It has no oscillators, at least not in a Green-Schwarz point of view. And it contains the supergravity multiplet, and it contains that many states. The first excited string level, well, you take what you've got, and you act on what you've got with the other things that you've got, that is oscillators. And you get something like this. It has 2 to the 16 states. It organizes in terms of SO9, as it should. And it breaks up like this. And the interesting and important fact for flat space, as well as for us later on, is that this actually forms a single multiplet of the 10-dimensional super Poincaré algebra. As one proceeds to higher levels, one has more oscillators to worry about. That is many more states of this kind, like 2 to the 32 and so. One has indices, one has everybody breaks up, again in representations of SO9. Everybody on the same string level has the same mass, and most importantly, everything breaks up into a large collection of super multiplets of super Poincaré, 10-dimensional super Poincaré. By this I mean that on each string level one has lots of multiplets. So let's see, what happens as we turn on weak curvature? Well, just counting, super Poincaré has, in 10 dimensions, has 32 supercharges. The 4-dimensional super conformal group has 32 supercharges. So at least the long representations are the same. So one might expect that the multiplet structure is not severely reorganized as one proceeds from flat space to ADS. Nevertheless, there is some reorganization that's needed because there is one thing that gets lost here, that is the mass, and there is one thing that is gained, which is the energy or the dimension. So the mass was constant within the multiplet, the dimension is not, but apart from this, nothing much should happen. If one thinks about it a little bit, and about the fact that perturbation theory is a series, introduces a new parameter, 1 over root lambda, one also quickly figures out that there is no way to mix levels, at least not in perturbation theory. That is, there is no way to mix string levels. So this reorganization that was being done up there has to happen sort of level by level. So in particular, for the first excited string level, we had one multiplet, there should be one multiplet, and it should be really the same multiplet. And then if one assumes that as lambda is dialed up and down, nothing, levels don't cross, then one reaches the statement that I made earlier, that the first excited string level should actually be dual to the Konishi multiplet. And well, these words have actually been implemented quite rigorously in this paper. So the way one does it is one takes the SO9 representations that appeared on the previous slide, one breaks them up this way, one promotes SO5 to SO6, and apparently there is a unique way of doing this. One embeds this SO4 in SO4,2, and this is where the energy comes in, and then this is then embedded in the full superconformal group. Representations are labeled this way, and this is how the spectrum is usually presented. Here is for the first excited string level, because he will be the main character. So one has a sum over Kaluza-Klein harmonics of something, and it is this something here that's really 1Q, 2Qs up to 32Qs, sorry, up to 2 to the 16 Qs that act on the ground state, which actually forms the Konishi multiplet, or the floor of the KK tower of the string of the first excited string level reduced to 4 to 5 dimensions. Right. So this is what you get, and this is stolen from these people's paper. So this is about half of the Konishi multiplet. The other half looks exactly the same, except you need to stand upside down. So the reddish guy here is the state that has been treated from a Y system, in a Y system approach, and we'll be talking about the other brownish looking states. Well, as far as I understand, you guys computed the energy of the state that's the element of the SL2 sector, right? And that's that guy.
But according to Arutyunov-Ralov, TBA equations are responsible for the whole multiplet.
Well, that's why there's a TBA there too, not just Y system. One should eventually check that what is said is actually happening. Right, Sergey? Accidents do happen, right? Okay. Anyway, I'll leave the TBA slash Y for a while there, if you don't mind. All right. So there is something interesting about the first excited string level compared to the higher levels, and that has to do with the fact that that I emphasized a little bit earlier that there is a single multiplet on this level. Right. So. Because of the symmetry algebra, one is supposed to find that the energies inside the multiplet are differing by integers or half integers. Right? So in particular, in this case, there is no coupling constant dependence in this variation of energy inside the multiplet. Because of this, one can actually, if one thinks a little bit, one can figure out that there is there cannot be a terrible mixing between vertex operators corresponding to the states on the first excited string level. In fact, one might even go as far as saying that within a single within a fixed Kaluza-Klein level, there should be no mixing at all. There might be some mild mixing as one includes several KK levels, but that's way too mild. By contrast, at higher levels, one has lots of multiplets, 2 to the 16 of them on the next string level in particular. So, and each of them can acquire can acquire energy that's different from all the others. So, in particular, they get different 1 over square root of lambda corrections. So, just on symmetry grounds, one can expect that basically every vertex operator mixes with every single other vertex operator as one go to higher levels, not on the first excited string level. And we're going to use this observation in a little bit. Now, since we mentioned mixing, and we know of another mixing problem that has been solved, using integrable models, one can, of course, ask the question, is there an integrable model that deals with this other mixing problem, the mixing of vertex operators on the worldsheet? Secondly, it's a integrable model whose Hamiltonian should really be L0 plus L0 bar. And, if we can solve such an integrable model and find perhaps not as much the energies, though those would, of course, be interesting as well, if one can find the eigenvectors of this guy, of this Hamiltonian, one could get a handle, a better handle, on correlation functions, two-dimensional form factors, and other things that involve vertex operators. So I'll make a couple comments about this a little bit later. For now, let me leave it this way. So since we got to talking about vertex operators, let's talk about vertex operators a little bit, and based on the little we know about them, try to figure out how the energy should depend on the other charges. So we know relatively little about vertex operators in ADS, but we know a little bit more if we throw away the fermions. So let's look at the bosonic theory, which is schematically written up here. So vertex operators have the following structure. They have really a three-factor structure. The first, maybe I should start with the last. The last factor is something analogous to E to IET in flat space. Here it's known as the bulk-to-boundary propagator, and it looks either like this in Poincaré patch or a little bit nicer in terms of the embedding coordinates. Then there's another factor here that deals with, that has derivatives acting on coordinates, and because of that it produces oscillators, so this part is responsible for the string level, or at least in a flat space limit is responsible for the string level. And then last but not least, there's another factor here which has bare Zs with no derivatives on them, and this is responsible for the Kaluza-Klein charge associated to this vertex operator. So with this structure in hand, one is supposed to compute the two-dimensional anomalous dimension, set it to zero, and solve for delta, or for the energy. So this would be, this gamma 2D would be the eigenvalue of this Hamiltonian. So we need to know a little bit more about this gamma 2D, and typically these guys are computed, can be computed in perturbation theory, at the very least. So with such a vertex operator, such a composite operator and such an action, one can proceed to some loop orders using Feynman graphs, but for exactly the same reason why at L loops in gauge theory we the anomalous dimension, the Hamiltonian, the spin chain Hamiltonian talks to L plus 1 fields. For the same reason here, the anomalous dimension matrix will have a charge dependence which goes like Q to the L plus 1. Right? So again, at L loops, one has at most L plus 1 fields coming out of this, which, for example, meet in one vertex that comes from this Lagrangian, and then out comes another operator which is either the same vertex operator or it's another vertex operator. So this is true for basically every entry of the anomalous dimension matrix. And again, this can be computed, and it's been computed in some cases by Wegener a while ago. So with the anomalous dimension matrix in hand, one is supposed to do this. And then diagonalize it, set it to zero, and solve. So having said all this, it seems relatively plausible that this integrable model that I was wondering about a couple of slides ago is in fact the same integrable model that we've been talking about for the last 7 years or so. The only difference is that instead of having the target space energy as Hamiltonian, we have another Hamiltonian. And really the difference between the Hamiltonian that we have been using and this Hamiltonian is really just a choice of gauge. Right? So we usually choose static gauge. We identify the worldsheet time with target space time, and that says that the worldsheet Hamiltonian is the same as target space energy up to some number. Here, in conformal gauge, well, the usual Hamiltonian is L0 plus L0 bar. So if we could solve the worksheet in conformal gauge, perhaps in an integrable model approach or by other means, one would diagonalize this guy, find gamma, find vertex operators, and eventually it will become better. But for now, we don't actually know how to do this, so this one will remain an open problem. Now, I was mentioning here two-dimensional, an almost dimension matrix. Well, again, for a generic level, the choice of words is accurate, but for the first excited string level, one can do, in fact, better based on the fact that, at least on the expectation, that there is no mixing. And because there is no mixing, one computes directly the eigenvalues of the would-be eigenvalues of the one-by-one anomalous dimension matrix. And then one gets a structure, just a regular function, which looks more or less like this. And one can identify in here the structure I was suggesting. Right, so the first bit that's linear in charges is the three-level contribution to the to this gamma. And it has really to do with this D, in fact. Then the bilinears are a one-loop contribution. And then, of course, there could be a linear piece. And then the cubic terms have to do with the two-loop contribution to the anomalous dimension. And then there are also quadratic and linear pieces and appearing at the same loop order, and so on. Now, this is the fact that the anomalous dimension is given by just one function on the first excited string level is really not indigenous to the first excited string level. It happens in other situations as well. And here is an example that I'm going to get to. But before getting to a more complicated example, here are some simpler examples of something like this. So strings in flat space. The marginality condition takes the usual Reggie form. So we have a J here, which is really just a string level, and we have a p-square contribution from the anomalous dimension of, say, e to I px, vertex operator. And here I kept only the energy part of it, if one goes to the center of mass. So that's the marginality condition in flat space. In ADS, we have something that looks similar, which is just quadratic. And that's just because it's just quadratic if one restricts, if one goes to the ground state, and that's just because there is no string level. And then the more complicated example, which actually is an example of vertex operator which doesn't mix with anybody, even though it seems to live on a higher string level. So it has, again, the structure I was advertising. And it has this E to I ET, analog of E to I ET, and then some other terms which, if you squint a little bit, looks a lot like R right movers and R left mover creation operators. So if one computes the two-dimensional anomalous dimension, one finds the three-level term by just counting derivatives. And then one finds a one-loop term. And then one also finds a two-loop term and so on. So in this particular case, one stares at this. One evaluates delta. One solves for delta. And that would be what one should do in the full strings in ADS. This calculation was done by these guys in a purely bosonic theory. If one includes fermions, things change a little bit. We actually don't know how they change, but they cannot change a lot. These numbers are bound to change, but the structure should remain the same. Now, based on this, we can write a general form for what to expect in ADS. And here is a shortened version because it didn't fit. But again, we have something linear, something quadratic, plus linear corrections, and so on. And here is a slightly longer form, which is, again, supposed to apply to the first excited level, because only there we would expect a single function. So there are some clarifications that I need to make. Notice here e minus 4, whereas here I just wrote an e square. So you should think of this e square as e minus a constant, which we don't really have under control for now. And then the other constant is pushed on the other side, on the right-hand side of the equation. The same goes for this j. is here there is a JJ plus 4 here. There, everything depends on J, on J. So you should think of J as J shifted by some constant. But the only thing that these constants do is they reshuffle a little bit these free coefficients. So we can parameterize everything this way without loss of generality. Now, if you stare at this a little bit, there are some things that strike you. And these would be some potentially missing terms, in particular terms that look like this. So some high powers of the energy, some high powers of J that stand alone, and so on. There is, in fact, an argument why they shouldn't appear, or better said, that they could appear, but they depend a lot on the scheme in which the anomalous dimension is computed. So one argument is, imagine going to the BMN limit. You are supposed to find E equals J as solution to the marginality condition and no other garbage. If you have such powers, you can get lots of other garbage, in particular K more solutions, which you don't want. From another point of view, if one thinks of, say, computing a beta function equation, of computing equations of motion for string fields by computing, say, beta functions on the worksheet, we expect them to be just box plus stuff equals interactions, whereas having E squares, whereas having higher powers of E in those equations would suggest some higher derivative quadratic terms for higher string fields, which, again, we don't really want, and we know that they are scheme dependent. So this is the reason why these guys haven't been included in this expression. Now, there are some more terms that could potentially have appeared, and they haven't been written, and they, again, look some like some higher powers of E times this N, which plays the role of string level. Now, it turns out that such terms could be included without actually any penalty, because we are supposed to treat this as an equation that is solved perturbatively at large lambda. So if such things are included, it turns out that one can still find perturbatively roughly the same equation as here up to, again, slight redefinitions of these coefficients. So in a sense, this has already been included by just renaming these coefficients. Last but not least, this equation has a direct flat space limit. All you have to do is pick the leading term at large lambda. So you find E squared equals N, which is just this, and that identifies N with the string level, or at least some kind of effective string level. And then finally, and the observation that we are going to use, pretty much every single word that I said for the last 5 minutes or so did not really refer to vertex operators corresponding to states with small charges or fixed charges or charges that are restricted in any way. So this equation is supposed to hold for pretty much all states for any values of J and N, in particular those that scale like square root of lambda. So we're going to use this to justify earlier semi-classical approaches to the energy of to the calculation of the energy of Konishi multiple. So here's the plan. We're going to use this universality to find these coefficients by inspecting semi-classical calculations expanded in a short string limit, which really just means that the charge densities are assumed to be small rather than large. If several such semi-classical expansions exist, one is supposed to check that they both give the same kind of values for these coefficients, and to the extent that we checked, they actually do. So as I was trying to emphasize, this approach justifies semi-classical approach to the calculation of energies of quantum string states, or at least for some quantum string states. And it also, at least in a worksheet approach, it gives a way to test whether symmetries are realized and how are they realized. In particular, for whatever coefficients we find for solutions that are supposed to be in the same multiplet, the resulting energy is supposed to come out the same, even though these coefficients, n's, are not necessarily the same within the same multiplet. So I should perhaps emphasize that the fact that these coefficients don't actually come out the same for all states in the multiplet is really a manifestation of the fact that that the calculations, as we do them, don't manifestly preserve supersymmetry. However, the fact that the energy comes out the same is a reflection of the fact that even though it's not manifestly preserved, PSU2.2/4 is in fact present behind the scenes. So, this is what we want to get, and this is the relation between that and quantum string states. One is supposed to take this, solve it, and expand for fixed charges and large lambda, and this is what you roughly get. The floor of the Konishi tower of the Konishi multiplet corresponds to n equals 2, j equals 2, as it turns out, and to get higher levels, one is supposed to take this and tensor it with this particular representation of SO6. All these guys are supposed to be the same within the multiplet. And the fact that, so really tensoring with J, all that it does is that it changes this, the value of this J that appears explicitly in here. So really, realization of symmetries implies that basically all these coefficients that appear here, so the coefficient of J should be independent, of any power of J should be independent of, should be the same within the same, the whole multiplet. And also these combinations of n coefficients should also be the same. In particular, one should be able to check that these combinations are as stated, namely they are fixed. Right, so n not 1 here has to be fixed because it's the coefficient of j square. This combination has to be fixed because it's all that's left of a1 once you throw away j square, which is clearly universal. And the same goes for this guy which appears here and so on. Now, so that's what we actually want to get once we have some numbers for these guys. The way we compute these n's, we do the calculations in the regime where the charge density is fixed, and then everything is expanded at large lambda, and then it's expanded at small n, and then it's expanded at small curly j in this particular order. So this is what you get if you solve this equation. So it's a little bit long and a little bit disgusting. The thing to notice is that pretty much on every single line in front of every single 1 over root lambda to some power, there are lots of dots. So in particular here, this expansion never really terminates. It's a non-trivial function of n and j. And the same goes here, and the same goes there, and so on. So clearly, if we could determine this equation rather than that semi-classical expansion, it would be so much better. We need to find just polynomials as opposed to these things. And not to mention that in here we would actually find, out of each of these long functions, we would actually find a small number of coefficients anyway. Right. Something else I meant to say here. But anyway. Oh, yeah. So even though this each of these expansions is a long expansion, one sometimes can resum. At least the small j expansion can be resummed. By the way, how much time do I have left? 15 minutes. Okay, thank you. And this resummation makes contact with the so-called slope functions that have been derived recently. So to get to the slope functions, one is supposed to take this E and organize it as a formal expansion in small n. Then one has these H functions, which are functions of lambda and J. And this is how they look in terms of those m coefficients. And then if one takes the square root and expands at large lambda and if one expands at small n and fixed J, one finds these things, and the slope function is this H1, the coefficient of the coefficient in the term linear in n in the string level. So in the SL2 sector, this expression for J, for H1, was conjectured by Benjamin a while ago and then proven by Benjamin and Nikolai. The analogous function in the SL2 sector is a little bit more intricate. Oh, yeah, I should say this conjecture is based on ABA and the proof as well. The SL2 sector story is a little bit more intricate, and there is a conjecture based on an analytic continuation from the SL2 sector due to Nikolai and Matteo Beccaria and Arkady Zaitlin. So here is what we know about these H functions. So I repeat here the expansion in terms of the coefficients that we had. So in the SL2 sector is a simple logarithmic derivative of a Bessel function, which looks like this if it is expanded at large lambda, or like this at small lambda. In the SU2 sector, the relevant analytic continuation is this one. And basically one flips some signs here and there. So there is the importance of this function is that it provides information on the n2-1 coefficient. I guess I didn't say what these n coefficients are, really. So again, going back. So there are some coefficients here that appear at each loop order. So n2-1 is one coefficient which appears in front of one over root lambda, and it is really a genuine two-loop term in this expression. So anyway, the importance is that it determines, at least in the SL2 sector, this coefficient n2-1, and it determines it to be -1/4. And really, this is the only information about this coefficient that we have available at the moment. So with this information in hand, we can proceed to actually analyze some classical solution and see what we get. So to make sure that we have solutions that live in the same multiplet, it would be nice to have a flat space picture for these guys and make sure that at least there they live in the same multiplet. And if they sit on the first excited string level, then they presumably will sit in the same multiplet as we turn on curvature. So there are two classes of solutions which are easily analyzable. So one is circular strings, and the other one is the folded strings. So this is the flat space excuse me, circular string solution. This is the flat space energy with the string level related to the two angular momenta in the two planes. And the corresponding vertex operator is this one. So for J1 equals J2 equals 1, they actually live on the first excited string level. The folded string is slightly simpler. It involves rotation in only one plane. And again, the energy has the usual Regi expression, and this would be the vertex operator. So for S equal to 2, this one sits on the first excited string level. As one, I should say here, we picked two particular planes to write these solutions, and here one. Of course, there is such a circular string oriented in a random way in 10 dimensions, but they are all related by Lorentz transformations. And the same here. One can, of course, add on top of this translational momentum, and that translational momentum translates, once we turn on curvature, into Kaluza-Klein momentum. So these are the corresponding solutions in ADS5 cross S5. And of course, it depends how the flat space ones were oriented. We can embed both planes in ADS for circular strings, both in S5 and one plane in each. And the same for the folded string. And if one actually fishes out the relevant charges and scours through the Konishi multiplet table, then one can identify that they are these particular representations. And some of them are unique, which is what led to these identifications, and some of them are not, but because of the expected symmetry, it's been identified to be this way. So the idea would be to evaluate loop corrections for generic values of these guys, expanded, again, in a semi-classical kind of expansion. In that regime, they are no longer in the same multiplet once curvature is included, but they do go back to the same multiplet as we take the short string expansion. Now, in the calculation, it turns out that there are a number of subtleties, and they have to do with making sure that the calculation actually preserves the four-dimensional superconformal symmetry. That has to do with regularization and how it plays with symmetry. So if in a quantum field theory that's Lorentz invariant and it's an infinite volume, there's a limited choice of regulators which preserve as many symmetries as one wants. And, there are dimension regularizations, higher derivative regularizations, cutoffs usually don't do too well unless they are finely tuned. If we put the QFT in a finite volume, the choices are become wider just because space and time are treated differently. And in a theory that's supersymmetric, at least in a two-dimensional sense, it's been argued that there's one particular regularization which preserves that symmetry, which preserves supersymmetry, and that is the mode number cutoff. And in fact, this argument has been formulated for diagonal propagators. Okay. Now, so it would be good to do something that looks like a mode number cutoff, at least for this reason. Now, if the propagators are off-diagonal, then the choices are even wider, because for off-diagonal propagators, we really don't quite have a natural I-epsilon prescription, so we can do almost anything we want, as long as we make sure that the symmetries we want preserved are actually preserved. So, for example, one can expand each field in modes, and then assign to each mode its own I-epsilon prescription. And if one does this, then one finds that the two-dimensional energy, which is related to the target space energy, looks a lot like this. Basically, one can sum every single frequency, every single mode frequency with essentially a sign of one's choice, provided that the restrictions that we hold true should actually be realized. In particular, we would like that if the solution has a BMN limit, this thing actually does have a right BMN limit. We want things to be finite. We want things that are in the same multiplet to be in the same multiplet and come out with the same energy, and pretty much the list goes on. There are, however, a few things which are relatively insensitive to these signs, and they have to do with the transcendental part of these guys. As long as one makes sure that everything is finite in the ultraviolet, then the transcendental part, which deals with the high momentum behavior, there should be an end there, which deals with the high momentum behavior in this sum should, in fact, be independent of the summation prescription. So with this being said, and with me running out of time, here are some results regarding these n coefficients. So if we look at the near BMN expansion, and we require that it is universal, we already find a couple of these coefficients, in particular n0 1, which is here, and n0 1 tilde, which is somewhere further down the road. The other coefficients, which look like n not something, which are all determined by classical physics, they come out to be all rational, just because solutions are expandable with rational coefficients, but they also come out to be state-dependent. As one proceeds to analyze the folded string and the circular string, one finds that this particular relation is realized. So this was supposed to be finite because of symmetry restrictions, and it comes out to be 2. And then these relations are also realized, and that guarantees the universality of the J dependence in the expansion of the slope function. So all these n's here, they are... So this n comes out to be the same, and just with a sign difference, which... is consistent with this sign difference here, where this one versus this one. So more properties. It turns out that this guy is, one can see it very quickly, that this guy, the zeta 3 term, in the one loop coefficient here is universal within the multiplet. And based on the fact that this n2-1 coefficient coming out of the SL2 slope function is -1/4, one identifies this combination, which should be fixed, to be -1, so this number should be universal. Now, we don't have another calculation for n2-1 for now, but we will have it at some point. But we will see exactly what we should expect based on the universality of this coefficient. Well, what we should expect is that, as we compute n12 prime and n not 3 for other solutions, it turns out that this n to 1 should be minus a quarter universally for everybody in the for all the all the solutions corresponding to states in the Konishi multiple. So there's an obvious question, why is it universal? And there is another obvious question, this is really something that comes out of a two-loop calculation on the worldsheet. Yet it is rational. Why is it rational? It suggests that something more fundamental happens, and it's really not a two-loop calculation, or at least not a full-fledged two-loop calculation, but it's not immediately clear what it is. There's more universal behavior that can be found by analyzing these guys, and that's what I was mentioning earlier, that all the n1k coefficients contain a zeta 2k minus 1, and these guys are all universal, and that's these 15 quarters are related to the 15 halves that I was mentioning earlier. So this is a table of coefficients, in case you care to memorize it, that came out of folded strings and circular strings, and the question marks are coefficients which, at least here, are fixed by coefficients which are fixed by symmetries but haven't been actually directly computed. So since I'm really out of time, I won't show you the details of any one of the calculations, but it's the usual fare. You write characteristic equations, you find frequencies, you sum frequencies, you expand, you identify coefficients, and you're home free, and you find something like this. Once you take the coefficients that you found and plug them into the quantum string expansion. So with this being said, let me go to my summary. So I've been trying to sell you a general structure of the energy of energy of short strings as a function of conserved charges, and this is based on vertex operators, and to the extent that we carried out calculations, it seems to hold. I should perhaps have said earlier, but let me say it now, that not all the states that appear in a multiplet, or at least in the Konishi multiplet, should have a semi-classical expansion. It should have a semi-classical counterpart, so one should be careful with one chooses and picks when one does calculations of this sort. The result is this one for the energy up to second order, and with the prediction that the two-loop sigma model calculation that goes into this B2 coefficient should yield a rational coefficient, which is again surprising, and also should yield a universal coefficient, which is equal to minus a quarter, and exactly why that happens we don't know, but it should happen anyway. And well, last but not least, pretty much all the open questions I was listing earlier are still open. Thank you.
Questions?
So why do you say you expect only a few states of the multiplet to be visible semi-classically?
Well, for starters, half of them shouldn't, because they are fermionic. And then there are lots more that, even though they are bosonic states, they actually differ by the action of Qs, so they will contain fermionic zero modes as a quantum state, and we don't really
you say fermionic doesn't work together with classical, basically.
Yes? So despite all those arguments, do you know why for higher mod numbers this approach doesn't give the correct result, it seems?
I can take a guess. I'm not going to bet anything, but I'm going to take a guess that it doesn't work because of mixing. So I was trying to sell that on the first excited string level, we have one multiplet, so the mixing is essentially, the mixing of vertex operators is essentially absent. Now, so not only it's absent, well, it is absent, but it's given by, the two-dimensional anomalous dimension is given by something like this. Now, as you go to higher string levels, you would have a big matrix, 2 to the 16 by 2 to the 16, and in each of its entries, you will have something like this, which one is first supposed to diagonalize, and then it's one is supposed to solve for the energies out of the algorithm.
What does the classical calculation
would you repeat? Is it a mean value?
It's a mean question.
Some kind of a statistical average, whatever that means.
I actually have a related question about the mixing. So should we expect that for higher levels the expansion is going to be not in powers of 1 over square root of lambda, but in powers of 1 over fourth root of lambda because of this mixing?
What I can tell you is that the expansion of each entry of the anomalous dimension matrix will depend on root lambda only. What happens when you diagonalize that big matrix is, from my perspective, an open guess.
So that's the question. Should we expect the appearance of 1 over fourth root of lambda terms?
I don't know. Perhaps.
Well,
perhaps
I think I know the answer.
Well.
So any more questions? If not, then...
I don't know.
And that's why the semi-classical approach doesn't work.
Because well, we don't really know
in the semi-classical approach, you always get expansion in powers of 1 over square root of lambda. You never get 1 over fourth root of lambda.
But we don't know how to compute a whole matrix semi-classically, so I can't tell you. Right. Until we figure out a better way of doing this, the answer is still maybe.
Okay, then let's thank the speaker again, maybe all the speakers.